Shortly after 9/11, a friend approached Jeff Charlotte and asked him to talk to her brother because she was worried that her brother had joined a cult. Jeff found more than he ever imagined. The brother hadn't joined a fringe cult. He'd joined a fundamentalist organization which has been described as the most powerful organization you never heard of. Jeff, thank you for talking with me.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Your book, The Family, the subtitle is The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got to know this group and how it works?
Sure. Well, you know, as you said, this friend said, would you speak to my brother and see if he got involved with a cult? I've been writing about religion for many years, so she thought I would be a good person to check in with. And when I spoke to the guy, he said, look, you've really got to come and see this thing for yourself. And I said, well, what is it that you want me to see? And he was very vague about it. Well, what ended up happening is I ended up moving into a house called Ivanwald, which was sort of a training house for youngish men being groomed for leadership in the family. The family is an international network. It dates back 70 years. It started out there in the Northwest, in fact. And it's dedicated to this idea that Christianity got everything wrong for 2,000 years when it talked about the poor, the weak, the suffering, the down and out. The founder, back in 1935, had what he thought was an actual new revelation from God telling him that the people who mattered are not the down and out, but those whom he would call the up and out, the already powerful. And he developed this gospel of more power for the powerful. So in accordance with that, the family's headquarters are just outside Washington, D.C., and the people they care about converting are not you or me. It's congressmen, it's military officers, it's ambassadors, it's business CEOs, it's foreign politicians. That's what they call their mission field, the people that they orient their religious outreach to.
And as I said in the introduction, this isn't some sort of fringe group. They've actually been terrifically successful in converting lots of powerful people, haven't they?
They have. Some of the men and women I write about in the book include Senator Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas, Senator Jim Inhofe, Republican of Oklahoma, Senator John Ensign, Republican of Nevada. Unless you get the wrong idea, it is not entirely Republican, it's about 80%. There's also Senator Mark Pryor, conservative Democrat of Arkansas, Senator Bill Nelson, conservative Democrat of Florida. And the list goes on and on and on. Maybe the most visible, or perhaps the only visible sign of their power, something called the National Prayer Breakfast, which is held every year at the Washington Hilton. The President of the United States always addresses it. There's about 4,000 guests, and most of Congress goes. C-SPAN broadcasts it. They present it as a very ecumenical event. It seems to be a public event. Your invitation comes on congressional letterhead. If you're a reporter like me, you RSVP to the White House. And yet, it's entirely privately financed, privately organized by a deeply sectarian group, the family. One document that I found, a planning document, says anything can happen at the National Prayer Breakfast. Even the Quran could be read. But Jesus is there. He is infiltrating the world. And privately, the family refers to the National Prayer Breakfast, which they began organizing back in 1953, as a recruiting tool. It's just the sort of the first level. Lots of people will go to the prayer breakfast who are not fundamentalists, but they are looking for those whom they can bring into what they call a man-to-man relationship with Jesus.
Well, that man-to-man part is one of the keys, isn't it? How do they feel about women?
They think women are just great in their place. Like many fundamentalists, they subscribe to this idea of male headship. This is the idea that gender relations have a very specific pattern laid out in the Bible, and that as Jesus is to humanity, so a man is to his family. Now, they'll say, hey, look, we're very forward-thinking. We don't think women are less than men. We think they're separate but equal. I mean, I've actually heard that phrase used, separate but equal, as if that phrase isn't one of the ugliest in American history. But the interesting thing about the family, though, they will make exceptions for very powerful women. And one of the things that distinguishes them from the conventional Christian right, in many ways, are not terribly doctrinaire. Their bottom line is power. And if there's a powerful woman out there, well, they'll effectively gender her as a man and treat her as a man and relate to her as if she is what they call literally the key men. They think God has chosen a set of key men for leadership around the world.
Can you give our listeners an example of how their influence works? I know they were instrumental in keeping Suharto in power. Maybe you could give us a little background on who Suharto is and how they worked with him.
Yeah, well, in the book, in the family, I sort of try to tell a narrative history of how their influence grew from first the Northwest, and I don't know if some of your listeners out there with a sense of history may remember the name Arthur Langley, who was a longtime governor of Washington and got to that place very explicitly with the family's help. He was sort of their first project. And on the strength of that success, they moved to the other Washington, Washington, D.C., and during the Cold War began playing a very significant role as a sort of a middleman between American power and various dictators, and sometimes more than a middleman. And in the case of Suharto is one that I go into some depth in the book, in part because Suharto was so horrifying. He was a dictator of Indonesia, took power in a coup in the 1960s, and killed, by conservative estimates, 500,000 of his own citizens. And some listeners might also be familiar with the genocide in East Timor. That was one of Suharto's projects, and a project he undertook, incidentally, with a green light from Henry Kissinger and with a military almost entirely armed with U.S. weaponry. How does the United States get into a relationship with such a monstrous killer? And when I went back and I looked at the family's archives, and that was the lucky break for this book, was that they had dumped 600 boxes of papers in Billy Graham's archives. And I looked at their archives and then was able to cross-reference with official government archives. You see the family very early on in 1966 identifying Suharto as a man of God. They were attracted by his strong sort of authoritarian veneer, which is what they think the message of the gospel is, and by his anti-communism. And they very quickly began organizing congressional junkets, sending senators and representatives over to spend time with Suharto, and they also sent oil executives because, of course, Suharto controlled the biggest oil corporations in the world. And these men would pray to Jesus with Suharto, who is a Muslim. But Suharto saw the advantage he was going to have by praying to this Jesus. And so he says, look, okay, I'll meet with your guys, and we'll talk about this American God. And, of course, in return, he got quite a bit of help from these guys. And Suharto, at one point in one of his letters to Doug Coe, the leader of the group, says, in this way, nobody converts us. Rather, we convert ourselves. So, I mean, it's a sort of a horrible story all around, but it's really the pattern for their relationships with foreign dictators. It's one being played out today. Senator Sam Brownback and Representative Joe Pitts of Pennsylvania, both core members of the family, are responsible for something called the Silk Road Act, passed in 1999 and passed, renewed in 2006, that funnels U.S. aid to dictators in the Central Asian region. And again, there's that oil and connection in the sense that this U.S. aid to these horrible dictatorial regimes is proving very beneficial to a lot of American corporations that have pipeline interests, natural gas interests, such as Koch Industries, which happens to be Senator Brownback's chief financial backer. So you get this sort of nice tautological loop of power.
So what they do is they contact people in the business community who have money, use their money to fund senators and congressmen's races so that they get in to vote. And once they're in to vote, they vote in financial support for people that are really not very nice.
Well, you know, it's actually in some ways it's a little scarier than that. You know, and one of the arguments I make in the family is so often the American media goes looking for the scandal, goes looking for the envelope stuffed with cash, and thinks if we can just find that envelope, then we'll know how power really works. And the story of the family that goes back decades is of a religious right group that recognizes that power, you know, an envelope full of cash, sure, that's going to move things, but ideas are going to be more powerful. So, no, they're never organizing a campaign so directly in the way that you describe. give your money to this guy and vote for this guy. In fact, they'll never tell you to vote for anybody. They'll never, you know, if you're a member, if you're a congressional member of the family, they're never going to say vote on this way on that or that way on that bill. Rather, the way they describe it working is they bring congressmen into what they call prayer cells. These are small groups in which you meet ideally once a week. They're organized for you by Doug Coe, the leader. You don't so much study the Bible as what Jesus reveals to you as key men in private about what he wants. And they'll say, now these are, they're described in the documents as invisible believing groups. It's important that they be invisible. They think that public scrutiny is a terrible thing. And they said, but these groups should not take action on their own. Rather, action should grow out of the relationships that occur there. So the Silk Road Act, that example I give you is how it works. So another example I talk about in the book is Dennis Bakke, the CEO, a former CEO of a giant energy corporation called AES, very nearly on Enron scale, used the event of the National Prayer Breakfast in the mid-90s to make contact with the dictator of Uganda, Museveni, who had long been designated the family's key man in that part of Africa, someone who would sort of collaborate with their schemes. And Bakke invites Museveni back for dinner at his house, which is in this neighborhood of properties all owned by the family, and brings them into this sort of relationship. And, you know, together they talk about Jesus. That's what they talk about. And next thing you know, Bakke has a $500 million no-bid contract for a hydroelectric dam in Uganda that pretty much everybody in Uganda is united in saying not only do they not need, it's going to make things worse. But the money flowed, and when objections were raised, Bakke hired the son of a National Prayer Breakfast organizer to go over to Uganda, and that man was very quickly accused of dispensing $400,000 in bribes, but there was no investigation because the country is led by a dictator who is the family's key man.
One of the things that I found interesting was the way that this kind of, it produces a groupthink, and it also absolves them of any individual responsibility for the decisions that they come to.
Exactly. You know, there's a great phrase for this I was pointed to by Will Wilkinson at the conservative Cato Institute. And he's looking at this as a member of the Cato Institute, which is a conservative Washington libertarian think tank. He's a real believer in the free market. And the family seems to be a believer in the free market, too. They use that same rhetoric. But what Wilkinson looks at this is not free market at all. This is self-interest by proxy. In a sense, you get together in your prayer cell, and you can't use your prayer cell to arrange a deal with that's going to benefit Coke Industries or someone, but your brothers might, and your brother's going to look out for you, and they are going to tell themselves, and they're going to tell you that they're doing God's work.
Their conception of God's work is very different from a lot of Christian thinkers. You quote one preacher from the family who says, "The symbol of the state is a sword, not a spoon feeding the poor, not a teaching instrument to educate our young, and the sword is an instrument of death." How do they reconcile this image with parts of the Bible like the Sermon on the Mount?
Well, you know, back at one National Prayer Breakfast some years ago, the family had gathered together Christian conservative student leaders from around the nation, and they had arranged for a seminar with a retired Marine general. He's talking about what Jesus says, and he says, now don't get me wrong, he says, Jesus said some crazy things too, like that whole Sermon on the Mount business. But the reality is, most of them think that they're expressing the Sermon on the Mount. They read the New Testament differently than most people, whereas a lot of people would see in Christ's teachings a message of perhaps of love or forgiveness or justice, they see as a common denominator power. They say, here's Christ, he can do anything, he's the most powerful individual in history. So this is what it's about, is power. Doug Coe, the longtime leader of the group, referred to by Time magazine as the stealth persuader, counseled every president since Nixon. Doug Coe often preaches on this idea that the three leaders of the 20th century who understood the New Testament, Christ's teachings, better than any other. Who is it? Is it Martin Luther King? No, it's Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. And it's this sort of jaw-dropping analogy. And he'll say, now, Hitler, Stalin, and Mao are evil men. We don't like what they did. But what they understood, that Jesus was teaching a gospel of total obedience, total authority, total commitment, totalitarianism, in effect. And that's the model that allows them to support dictators around the world. It's this idea that God works through these key men, and it doesn't really matter what they do. Morality, they say, is a concept for, essentially for the masses, not for them.
Okay, and I'm speaking with Jeff Charlotte about his book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Now, we're talking about something that's really not in the past. What do you think their influence is today? I understand Hillary Clinton had some sort of connection with this group.
Yeah, I first wrote about that with my colleague, Catherine Joyce, for Mother Jones magazine. And I've since written a little bit more about it for The New Republic. There's a chapter in the book in which I pair two associates of the family, Senator Sam Brownback, who gave me tremendous access, actually, and Senator Clinton, who didn't cooperate with the book, but a lot of people around her did. So I was able to draw this portrait. And the difference is Brownback is a member. Hillary is what they call a friend. And that's not a casual designation. A friend is someone who has a long-standing semi-formal relationship with the family. And Hillary calls Doug Coe, this man who sees with such great leadership lessons in Hitler, Stalin, and Mao, she calls him a genuinely loving spiritual mentor and guide. That's in her memoir, Living History. And in Living History, she also writes, in 1993, when she came to Washington, Doug Coe organized a prayer cell for her of conservative women, James Baker's wife, Susan Baker, Jack Kemp's wife, Joanne Kemp, and so on. So she has this long-standing relationship. That doesn't mean that she's some kind of secret stealth fundamentalist or anything like this. It means what it really reflects is Doug Coe's ideas on power. And he likes to say, we work with power where we can, we build new power where we can't. Their interest in Hillary Clinton was in her power. They would rather have access to her than be directly opposed to her. And they found that they could cooperate with her on certain issues. So you see that kind of relationship in Washington, and you have to ask yourself, well, is this a group that's going to suddenly go up in a puff of smoke if Obama's elected in November? And the reality is no. They're the oldest and most enduring Christian right organization in Washington. A survey by a sociologist of 360 top evangelical politicians, including Democrats, found that more named the family as most religious, most influential religious organization in Washington than any other, than James Dobson's Focus on the Family, than any religious group. They got the most votes. They're not going to disappear. But they have played, I think, a role in the campaign, and it became most visible, actually. And very, very rarely do we see these sort of schisms between the elite of the Christian right and the populist Christian right. And progressives really need to pay attention to these because that's where we can carry the fight. And the Mike Huckabee campaign was financed by a group of televangelists. A senator named Chuck Grassley, who was a very Christian conservative guy from Iowa, led an investigation into these televangelists. And it becomes clear that Grassley was from the part of the Republican Party that was very uncomfortable with even Huckabee's veneer of populism. And a little name-calling war broke out, which resulted in Huckabee's people challenging Grassley's investigation of these televangelists on the very basis. They said, look, Grassley is involved with the least transparent religious group in Washington, the family, so how dare he throw stones at us? That's where you see the family, I think, sort of intervening in elections. And it's also, I think, something that's sort of hopeful for progressives because you see fault lines. You see fault lines in what I think what a lot of progressives consider the sort of monolithic Christian right. It's not monolithic. It's a movement like any other with many factions.
Well, one of the things that I find cause for a lot of concern is their attitude towards democracy.
Yeah, they don't like it. that's definitely a concern. Right from the very beginning, when they began in Seattle in 1935, the story that I tell them in the book is going to great depth, actually, about the West Coast strike of 1934, led by a man named Harry Bridges. It was a massively successful strike all up and down the West Coast. It began with dock workers and moved on to many, many industries. A great sort of moment in American progressive history. And the founder of the family saw this and was absolute horror and thought that a strong man needed to come in and exert control. And he had been spending time, this founder, the man named Abraham Verratti. Verratti had been spending time ministering to guys like Henry Ford and James Farrell, who was the CEO of U.S. Steel Corporation, and Kenneth Kingsbury, who was the CEO of Standard Oil California. And they all sort of concluded that, look, if democracy is not going to stop the strikes and so on, what good is it? And they thought that democracy had run its course. They were pretty, Henry Ford was an open admirer of Hitler, and they decided that a theology would be their American alternative to fascism. They didn't want to be fascist, but they thought that Christianity could give them the anti-democratic force they needed. They called democracy the din of the vox populi, this pretentious little Latin phrase that means the sort of, you know, the ugly racket of the voice of the people. And they said, look, in the family, we're going to organize people into prayer cells so that they can make decisions beyond the din of the vox populi. When I lived with them for nearly a month, a story I tell in the first chapter of the family, they would often emphasize, remember, the kingdom of God, the kingdom that they think they're building here on earth, is not a democracy.
Right. Well, even though they didn't want fascism, they were awfully fond of Nazis.
Yeah, yeah. Chapter 5 of the book is called the F word, because fascism is such a loaded political term and an American political conversation. One of the things that I think we learn from the family is that we make a mistake when we say the Christian right are just fascists. And I'm not defending them. I'm saying there is more than one kind of reactionary under the sun. There's more than one kind of bad under the sun. And they were awfully close to fascism. And in the post-war period, in fact, they were given a mandate by the Department of State, and there's all these wonderful documents that help us tell the story, to go through the Allied prisons and select former Nazis who they thought could be instantly rehabilitated through Jesus for service in the new West German government. One such, for instance, was Hermann Abs, who became known as the Wizard of the West German Miracle. He was the leading financial figure for decades of West Germany, until it was discovered by the Simon Wiesenthal Center in the 1970s that before he became West Germany's banker, he had been known as Hitler's banker. They thought you could do a very quick switch. You would just go to somebody and say, are you ready to switch your loyalties from the Führer to the Father, from Hitler to their concept of God? It was pretty much a snap after that. That said, they never became fascist in the European sense. And one of the distinctions, and I think one of the things that has allowed them to endure 70 years, whereas European fascism obviously did not get nearly as far, was they recognized the power of peaceful rhetoric. So fascism, of course, openly reveres violence. In fact, thinks you can't really be a human being unless you participate directly in violence. The family says, oh, no, they don't like violence at all. It doesn't mean that they don't aid and abet about violence throughout the world. They do, of course, by increasing defense budgets for dictators and things like this. But it's not part of their rhetoric. The other thing that fascism, of course, does is identify an other, the hated other, Jews and Germany and communists and so on. The family doesn't do that. There's an element of it's country club fundamentalism, and they recognize that they can be much more influential if they don't talk about those whom they hate. Talking about who you hate is a weapon of outsiders, usually. You know, the populist Christian right, these guys who are pounding their pulpits and thumping their Bibles, these are outsiders who want power in Washington. The family has always been made up of insiders. They don't need to shout about their positions. They need to pursue them quietly. As George Bush Sr. praising Doug Coe, the leader, said at the 1992 prayer breakfast, says, I wouldn't quite call it secret diplomacy, I would call it quiet diplomacy.
But it really is pretty secretive. And that's what's interesting, too. With all the influence this group has, how have they managed to keep out of the public light?
They would get some press up until the 1960s when the founder Verratti died and the current leader, Doug Coe, took over. He sent out a memo to the leadership around the world and said, the time has come to submerge our public profile. We are going underground. Those are his words, underground and submerge. And what that meant was simple things. They're no longer going to use letterhead. They said, if you are doing something as a member of the family, say that you're doing it on your own initiative. In a sermon, he describes why he thinks this was a good thing. He talks about, and this sermon is actually available online. He says, his body, the body of Christ, the family, functions invisibly like the mafia. They keep the organization invisible. Everything visible is transitory. Everything invisible is permanent and lasts forever. The more you can make your organization invisible, the more influence it will have. You know, they've been able to do that. There's been a few investigations over the years. In the 1960s, the New Republic looked at the National Prayer Breakfast and recognized it for what it was, which was a massive off-the-books lobbying festival. In the early 1970s, Playboy did an investigation into the ways in which the family was functioning as an off-the-books bank for congressmen who were in financial trouble. In 2002, the Los Angeles Times did a massive investigation that should have prompted a huge follow-up in the American media. It didn't. 2003, I wrote about them for Harper's. No follow-up. And just this spring, NBC News, NBC Nightly News, did a segment on the book, on the family, and Hillary Clinton's connection to it. And I think they thought they had a major scoop. No follow-up. And it's one of the frustrating things about the American press is the irony is that conservatives and fundamentalists who say that the press discriminates against Christian conservatives, they are right in the sense that most of my colleagues in the media, they have a very strict image of what they think a fundamentalist is. It's someone like Jerry Falwell, it's someone like John Hagee. And when someone like Doug Coe comes along, this sort of quiet, smooth operator, very much an insider, doesn't push his Bible in your face, they don't even recognize him as what he is, which is a religious fundamentalist activist.
In the book, The Family, you go over different kinds of fundamentalism, and you talk about that there's the populist fundamentalism and there's the elite fundamentalism, which the family is part of this elite fundamentalism. But it seems when I'm reading your book and looking at what they believe in, it doesn't seem like that they have a core belief. They almost use Jesus as an excuse to do anything.
Well, yeah, there's a few core beliefs in there. One of them is something called biblical capitalism. And remember, you know, the family begins in the 1930s as a response to the Great Depression. And this idea that the Great Depression is a punishment from God, that the way that a nation can obey God is to essentially privatize its economy and to deregulate its economy. And that seems pretty cynical. And the effect of it certainly is. But in their view, what you're really doing is you are freeing up God's invisible hand. They make no distinction between the invisible hand of Adam Smith and the invisible hand that they see foretold in the Bible. They actually think that capitalism is an economic system that goes back to the Old Testament. So that's really kind of the core belief. And the other core belief, I think, that has been a constant for 70 years is a vision of American power in the world as not democratic but imperial. This is really an imperial theology. And when you're talking about imperial theology, the interesting thing, though, is that we're not talking about left wing or right wing. We're really talking about the empire wing. And that's why they're a little bit different than the fundamentalists that most of us are familiar with the news. For instance, they don't talk that much about abortion. They don't talk that much about same-sex marriage. It's important to remember, by the way, that there was times in which the popular Christian right didn't either. Everyone forgets that Billy Graham was once pro-choice. Those things they see as transitory. What's permanent is this matter of power, is this matter of biblical capitalism, is this matter of absolute sovereignty of their concept of God, and that's what roots them in the fundamentalist tradition.
Okay, so say we have a listener or somebody who picks up your book and they're interested in finding out whether their senator or their congressional representative has ties with the family. Is there any way of knowing who's part of this?
Yeah, it's not that hard, which is one of the ironies of the American press. It is secretive, but they've been sort of hiding in plain sight for so long that they've never really dealt with this idea of being challenged. And so many of them will talk about it. I mentioned Mark Pryor, the conservative Democratic senator from Arkansas, and I had heard from others about his involvement. It's pretty easy. I called him up and I asked him, and he said, yes, absolutely. I spoke with Senator Sam Brownback. I went out and visited with him in Kansas and went to his church, and he talked about how the family had helped him throughout his career from when he was a college kid and first moving to Washington to be a congressional intern, and they provided housing for him through 1994 when he came back to Washington as a U.S. representative, and they provided a prayer cell for him. You have to ask the questions. That's the issue. I think of John Ashcroft, the former attorney general, very involved in the family. You go in their archives, his involvement goes back to the early 80s when he's really kind of a nobody politician in Missouri, and he writes to Doug Coe, the leader. He says, look, I'm interested in infiltrating Jesus into American government. Can you help me? And, of course, Coe did. And when you go back and you look at the profiles of Ashcroft when he first became attorney general, they would note that he had a weekly prayer breakfast meeting. And most reporters would leave it at that. They wouldn't ask any further questions. They thought it would be disrespectful to do so. There's nothing disrespectful about asking someone who says their faith is part of their public life, well, tell us more about what your faith is and what is it involved in. So I would love to see, one of the outcomes of the book that I'd love to see, and it's starting to happen a little bit, is for people to take a look at their own congressperson, ask them about this. And I think what they'll find, for instance, a lot of representatives have been to something called the Senate Weekly Prayer Breakfast or the House Weekly Prayer Breakfast for senators and representatives, respectively, obviously. And this doesn't tell you much. Anybody can go to that. It's sort of like checking the box on piety, showing that, you know, oh, yes, I believe spirituality matters. So they say, yes, I've been to that, and that's no big deal. What you want to find out is, do they have a prayer cell that goes beyond that? What's their relationship with Doug Coe? These are questions that we should be asking of our representatives. Here's a man who says that Hitler, Stalin, and Mao is a good leadership model. Is that someone that you think is an appropriate spiritual counselor for your representative?
Now, Doug Coe's got some interesting connections to Oregon, too.
He does. He's out from that way. He's originally from Salem. And as a young man in the 1950s, as he was sort of rising in Christian conservative organizing, his power base, as it were, became Portland. One of his first coups, his first conversions, was a young political science professor at Willamette University named Mark Hatfield, who had been a Christian conservative. And Coe, although Coe was much younger, he was a college student, was able to bring Hatfield into a much more political sphere and a much more religiously conservative sphere. So on that, the strength of that outreach, that the family in Washington noticed him. In 1959, they invited him to move to Washington, D.C. And he left behind in Oregon a pretty extensive network of fundamentalist churches, houses in which young fundamentalist men were living in community, organizations like the Navigators that he'd been very involved in. Not a whole lot of that survives to this day. But in the book, I actually do have another Portland connection, which is when I was out there researching Doug Coe's early days, I ended up encountering the kind of populist fundamentalist church. They had no particular connection to the family, but what you saw in this church and this group of young people, very lovely people there in Portland, meeting together in these sort of house churches, you saw the effect of a sort of a trickle-down religion, which is how the family always thought it should happen, is that these ideas occur at the top and then spread out into the masses. And so you saw these family ideas of how religion and power works being echoed in the house churches of Portland, Oregon.
One of the lessons from the book, too, that I came away with was that when we look at fundamentalism and we kind of say, oh, well, its influence is going away, what you're showing in this book is that the fundamentalism is bedrock, solid, American. It's not going away. And even when it seems like it's changing its face, it's still there underneath, very strong.
We need to make the distinction between something called the Christian right and something called fundamentalism. The old incarnation of the Christian right, yeah, that's going away. Jerry Falwell is dead. Pat Robertson will be soon. James Dobson's power is weakened. John Hagee was never much more than a backbencher, and he's been pushed back onto that bench. But this idea that fundamentalism is weakening and disappearing from American life, the first time this shows up in the American press is not this spring. It's 1925, the Scopes monkey trial, the evolution trial. The American press almost uniformly declared fundamentalism gone, dead, defeated once and for all. And they've been doing so with regularity ever since. Just in recent years, if you go back and you look at the press, and you can track these stories where it says the Christian right is dead. There was a bunch this spring. The New York Times declared the Christian right dead this spring, as they did in 1996. Bill Clinton was reelected, and then in 1994, there's the Republican Revolution, and suddenly it's strong again. In 1992, they declare the Christian right dead once and for all. There's a really short memory. One of the interesting things that you learn when you spend a lot of time with the fundamentalist right, and I spend time obviously with the family, but also with populist leaders like Ted Haggard, the fallen megachurch preacher, is that they get this cycle and that they have a much longer-term vision. They're building institutions. They recognize that the political cycle is going to turn. Their favorite candidate might not be in office. They're thinking about how can we build for the long term. The populist Christian right is the one that grabs the headlines. The elite Christian right is the one that stays there, right at the heart of American power.
So the idea that the current crew that's in power was in it just for the money is probably pretty wrong. They're part of this whole set of ideals and this long-term vision.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, something, when we look at the family, we see this tremendous cronyistic potential of enrichment. But one of the terrible mistakes progressives make, and why they get beat again and again and again and again, is to assume, well, we're just much smarter than those fundamentalists, and they're just a bunch of greedy jerks in it for the money. They don't really believe anything. We believe things. They don't believe things. Well, that's not how social movements works. And the fundamentalism is, for better and mostly worse, a social movement. They believe that they are doing God's work. I think of someone like former Attorney General Ed Meese, Ronald Reagan's former Attorney General, who is a very core member of the family, hosts a weekly breakfast, and still very much a Washington power broker. He was the man who shepherded through the nominations of Justice John Roberts and Sam Alito to the Supreme Court. Meese is a guy who his entire career has been all ethically tangled up in various financial deals. But you spend time with Ed Meese, and there's no question he's not just in it for the money. He believes he is doing God's work, and that makes him such a much more dangerous, dangerous man. And I think in the current administration, you see that same kind of sentiment. Now, not everybody does. I think the sort of the talk amongst Christian conservative insiders is that Bush actually has pretty much lost his faith. They're not fond of him at all, and never were and nearly as fond of him as I think liberals thought they were. And that's where we make that mistake, in underestimating the sophistication of fundamentalism, but also its sincerity. Remember, sincerity is it's not in itself a virtue. The family's very sincere. They're very sincere about American empire.
What's your follow-up on this book? What's your current project?
Well, I write for Rolling Stone magazine and Harper's magazine. I'm doing a long piece for Rolling Stone right now on fundamentalism in the military. Spent some time at the Air Force Academy, where I was dismayed to find that the superintendent, three-star general, had no idea what the First Amendment said, had no idea about the Establishment Clause or the Free Exercise Clause, these guarantees of religious freedom in American life. And I also contributing editor for Harper's and working on a piece on the GI resistance movement, and got another couple books in the pipeline and working on this. I hope not to keep working on the family. I've been with them for 6 years now, and I think it's time for us to part ways. I've done what I could for them. I like to say that, you know, I know their history better than anybody within the family, so I almost imagine members of the family sort of reading this book with great fascination, because this is, it's their story. It's the story of religion really at the heart of American power, and I think what's going to happen in the future is we're going to start to see more and more. It's starting in amongst academics, actually, seeing graduate students writing dissertations about various aspects of the family. I know of one guy working on their relationship to East Germany, and another who's looked at their role in attacking organized labor. Others looking at their relationship to foreign policy. So as these studies get out there and become part of the body of work on religion and politics in America, I think there's going to be more and more scrutiny on the family over the years.
Okay, well, that's at least ending on a hopeful note here. Very scary book. I've been talking with Jeff Charlotte about his book, The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Jeff, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Marianne.